and Labor. And I'm going to open open session on Senate Bill 400.
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, Senate Bill 400A modifies the definition of employment relations in public collective bargaining to include staffing levels and on-the-job safety issues for public safety employees who are prohibited from striking. In front of you, Committee Members, you have an A-A6 amendment, which modifies the definition to include safety and staffing only as they relate to on-the-job safety, and there's no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact statement in your...
Okay. Thank you. I want to remind everybody, shut your phones, pagers, electrical devices off that communicate with the outside world. All righty then. Committee members, you have the language in your packet, and I think you've had it for a little while. And if you would like, I think I'm just going to call Brian DeLashmet and Bob Livingston up. Come on up. And to come in and just explain what this language does, please.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, all of which were covered by this bill. The A6 is a modification of the previous amendments. And they further clarify that any staffing issue that was to be discussed has to be related to safety. It can't be just staffing for the sake of staffing or a discussion that they want to have. That there has to be that linkage between a discussion of staffing and safety. And this language, as you can see, the safety stands alone, but then it says staffing only as they relate to on-the-job safety. Mm-hmm. And that's what it does. Pretty straightforward.
Bob, you have anything to add? Or?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. Nothing to add.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, gentlemen, in the original bill, which is in the same lines that this replaces, which will be so heavily discussed, they talked about staffing level, not staffing, as is in this amendment. Was that a deliberate change of the way it's looked at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, no, not that I'm aware of. Staffing levels versus staffing. I don't know that I even noticed that difference in the level was dropped.
Well, in my way of thinking, taking out levels makes staffing even a bigger issue, not a smaller one.
Well, in response, Mr.
Maybe that's maybe that is a comment to you, not to these gentlemen. Okay.
Thank you, Representative.
Staffing is a bigger word. Staffing levels is a bigger concept than staffing levels. I guess staffing is huge, and in this amendment, it just says staffing, not staffing levels.
Very good. Mr. Livingston?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, once again, I think this is just trying to clarify, and I think there was some concerns with respect to staffing as it relates to safety and on-job safety of the employee. So I'm just trying to attempt here.
Any further questions, comments, discussion?
Thank you,
gentlemen. I'll entertain a motion. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the dash A6 amendments to Senate Bill 400.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the dash A6 to Senate Bill 400. Is there any discussion? Representative.
I think I've made a point here. I will speak to the whole bill in a minute, but mm-hmm. I think this is even a bigger a hole in this. It is a change in the wrong direction in my mind, and I won't support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will make a comment.
Yes.
And I just want to say that I think the discussion about this bill previously has been that there seemed to be some ambiguity, which we didn't think was there originally, about whether the language of the bill referred only to staffing as it relates to safety. I think that we have made an effort, and I think made it very clear in this amendment that we're talking about staffing only as it relates to on-the-job safety, and so I think this accomplishes what we were set out to do.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Is there objection?
Yes.
No, sure.
Let the record note that Representatives Esquivel and Berger object. Thank you very much. Representative Rosenbaum. sure.
And we have to vote on this amendment?
I noted their objection. Kristen Caldwell on the amendment.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Vice Chair Falwell.
No.
Vice Chair Holmey.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Excuse.
Representative
Rosenbaum. Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 400 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 400 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're very indulgent, and I don't want to belabor this with Senate
Bill
400A.
Senate Bill 400A.
Thank you. I don't want to belabor this anymore, but I have to put on the record that this we have been down this road. We went to the floor. This bill, this language was under huge dispute at that time. When it was defeated on the floor, there was an agreement that a work group would work on this language and come to terms with some sort of agreement. I came late to the work group, but no agreement was made by the work group. I do not believe this language is a step in the right direction even, and I will again vote against this bill.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
Representative
Esco.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't matter if you have a box and you keep tearing off the wrapping paper off the box, you still have the same box. That's exactly what we're doing here, folks. No different than where we started. This is the same bill. It's the same language. It's the same ultimate means. So, therefore, I will be a no vote as well.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Well, I've seen the same bill fail on the floor, come back the very next day. So, and what a difference a day can make. That's what Representative Max Williams said that day. Anyway, we have beat this to death. It's really important to me. It's no secret. It's really important to the men and women who protect us. And respond to emergencies, and we have tried to come to some agreement, and some people agree, some people disagree. That's what we do in this building. We talk about language. That's what we do every single day, and we float ideas around, and sometimes we agree and sometimes we don't. Unless you're and just for the record, Representative Rosenbaum moved that we send Senate Bill 400A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Kristen, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Edwards. Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Vice Chair
Fulham. No.
Vice Chair
Holmey. Aye.
Representative
Smith. Excused.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Chair Shoffley.
Aye. And the chair will carry this on the floor. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 400A. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3301.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3301 requires state contracting agencies to award contracts for services in accordance with procedures that promote the investment of state funds in jobs and the economy of Oregon and the United States. It also requires contracting agencies to give preferences to local proposers, state proposers, and United States proposers. Under the measure, a business that submits a proposal to a state agency for a contract must disclose their personnel deployment plan, and the measure also provides exceptions for that to be disclosed. The Department of Administrative Services is directed to adopt rules to carry out the provisions of the measure, and there's an emergency clause effective on passage.
Thank you. Representative Clem and Representative Esquivel.
Where do you want to
be? Are you here?
Doesn't matter. All right.
We'll find out where he's here. We'll find out where he's here.
Okay.
Whenever you gentlemen are ready.
For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. This actually came about, this idea. Representative Clem and I got together, and we were discussing what had happened in Southern Oregon, where we had a $189 million bond levy, local bond levy, for schools. Unfortunately, the bid went out of the area and into the Portland area, so consequently, the majority, in fact, all of the profit in that particular $190 million will be moved out of the area. So therefore, we sat down and tried to work a bill that would have an inclination to use local contractors, local people, especially with local money and local bonding of state and county money. So that's kind of how we got here. I'm going to let Representative Clem finish up here, and because it's really, it was his bill, and I tacked onto it because of this situation, so we worked together on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Clem, State Representative from House District 21 here in Central and East Salem. And This is one of my major issues in general, the idea that we should do what we can to put Oregon first in all ways, really. The Brand Oregon process that we've worked on is part of this. And we had a bill earlier to help have Oregon farmers feed Oregon kids. It's called the Farm to School Program. We just passed three bills all related to this same concept within K through 12 school lunches out to Ways and Means with a unanimous bipartisan vote. And this is sort of the larger look at the rest of state contracting. I'm a small business owner. I don't do business with any parts of government. But I am part of the Chamber of Commerce, and I'm part of a lot of other local small business groups that do try and do business with government. And often they have a very difficult time doing it because they end up losing to an out-of-state, sometimes a international contractor. And there are people who, great products, the chairs, the desks, the services that we do contract for are often outsourced outside of the state. And so initially that's where I sort of came looking at this. How do we give a preference to an Oregon business that is using its tax dollars to employ people here, and how can the state tax dollars that are being spent by those very same people be used to help them rather than work against them and give their competitors an advantage over them with their own money, which is irritating to them? And I've got one of my colleagues who can speak to that here from the local Salem business community. So I thought, well, let's look at having some sort of preference given in contracting that also has cost containment, so you don't just break the bank in case the local person is, you know, really way out of whack with price, or they're gouging, or, you know, I'm sure there's always potential for abuse. So Representative Escobar and I started talking about it, and he had brought up the really local concept of the county that the service or good is being provided in. Really, it'd be nice if it stayed there initially. So what this bill does is says simply, and there's some problems with it already that I can talk to you about in terms of amendments, but it's...
You're not
supposed to say that. Oh, you're not supposed to say that. Well, I'm trying to be honest, trying to get a workable bill. We can do that in Ways and Means after you vote it out. How's that? It says, in the county that the service or person or good is provided in, give the first shot to the contract to some company from that county. And if they are within 7.5% of the low bid from someone who's basically out of the country, then give it to the person from the county. If there's no one in the county who can do it, you then look at the person from within Oregon, the company with Oregon, and you say if they're within 5% of the low bid, it goes to Oregon company. Then we say 2.5% if they're an American company competing against an international company. And then, you know, I think we got another bill that would ban all contracts from going to overseas companies. So that's not spoke to in this bill, but there's another bill, and that would be my preference. Is I just don't like seeing Oregon tax dollars spent on international corporations that are doing business here in Oregon. They can be here in the free market. That's great. I just don't want to see tax dollars going for that activity. That's basically the bill. There are some issues that I can talk to you about in the question-answer period if you like. In terms of does this cover everyone or just some of the agencies that DAS can oversee, and there's some agencies not in here that really should be if we're going to, you know, try and be comprehensive about this. I'm open to ideas that people have, but this is what we're trying to do to get started on this this session in terms of moving our state dollars towards our own companies.
Thank you, gentlemen. In 2003, it was brought to our attention that our license plate manufacturing was outsourced from a Southeast Portland company to a Canadian company. Those Canadians. Anyway,
Chair, look at your sheet, Mark.
And Representative Rosenbaum brought it to our attention, and we passed a bill up. I believe we got that contract back, and there were several. It had an impact on several jobs that happened to be union jobs too, as well. And conceptually, I'm with you. You will be hearing some concerns, and I'm glad we're willing to work to see if there's something we can put together. Because, and people beat up on corporate America, but I'll tell you guys, I'll take corporate America over to corporate China any day of the week. I got nothing against the Chinese. My friend here and I spent a nice week over there together last year, but I will take corporate America over corporate China. Any questions for these gentlemen?
No, but would Representative, you ask me another question? I don't know what the proposers and amendments or whatever, but it seems to me that there's some ways and means questions in here, and I wondered if there's a subsequent referral or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, no, at this point there's not.
There probably needs to be honest, because there would be fiscal impacts to the contract.
And actually, to clarify, there is a fiscal impact statement in the works. It just was not ready for today's hearing.
Okay.
But it's in the works.
There's some. I won't ask those questions because I don't have them. Right.
Very good. Representative.
Mr. Chair, I think what we're trying to do, which is blatantly obvious, we're trying to protect Oregonians. We're trying to protect Oregon business. Let's keep our money in Oregon and let it work for Oregon.
And I think we should produce all our wood fiber products from wood fiber cut and felled and milled right here in Oregon.
If I could sing, you'd be preaching to the choir.
Yes, sir. Any, and along with some other things. Representative?
I just was going to mention that, you know, we'll all work on this with fiscal, but part of what we may have to think about in the legislature is if it comes back and says it's going to cost, you know, 3% more in every single contract in the state, or they do worst case scenario, it's going to cost 7.5% more in every single contract. We know from lots of studies that there's a multiplier effect of a dollar that is spent here. That won't show up in our fiscal, unfortunately.
Right.
But we know that. We know that when we spend a dollar here in the local economy, instead of exporting the dollar to a corporate headquarters in a different part, it's got real impacts that come back in tax revenue and jobs and quality of life. And that's the part that I'm going to have to probably work with Ways and Means folks on, if it makes it that far, on how do we factor in when our legislative fiscal says this other thing we know happens but won't make it into the paperwork for our analysis here.
Yeah, and in defense of those, in the conversation in 2003, in defense of outsourcing, we have, as a legislature in the past, went and instructed and directed our bureaucrats to go out there and be as frugal as they can with our money. And this has led, some of this has led to outsourcing of what we purchase and contract out for goods and services.
Good rule of thumb when I was in Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development, Mr. Chair, was that for every dollar that's brought into community, it's a $3.84 trickle down.
Mm-hmm.
So for every dollar we bring in, it generates $3.84.
Representative Holby, did you have your hand up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just maybe we'll talk to the proponents of the bill later. I have a couple concerns, I suppose, about it, and I can bring those up at a later time.
Very good. All right. Any further discussion, questions of these gentlemen? Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Teamwork bill, right?
Yeah, that's right. You can get a work session if you insist on it. You work out the bill, and by God, we'll do it. Let me see here. I'm going to hear from the other side while the representative is still in the room. Jessica Adamson and Jim Craven, please. Are you ready?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. With a lot of concerns about this legislation and its impact, quite frankly, on, I think, the same small businesses this bill is intended to help. While at the moment this legislation does not include construction contracts or even contracts for goods, which are a separate contracting process in statute, it does relate to services, which can include some construction management services, which my firms provide. We are concerned about this because, as you may be aware, when we establish a preference here locally, that preference works against us in other states. Virtually all states have the same kind of provisions we have in Oregon that are set out in ORS 279A that say, Oregon will apply a preference against out-of-state firms that have a preference in their advantage in their state. So, for example, Alaska, which has a 5% preference in favor of in-state contractors, if an Alaska contractor, for whatever reason, were to decide to come to Oregon, when they submit their bid to an Oregon agency, we would apply a 5% disadvantage against that firm as we evaluate their bid. if for Oregon firms, if this legislation were to pass and they were to, say, go work in or try and get a job in Vancouver, they would have a preference applied against them to the same extent that this bill provides an in-state advantage. So for those small firms that are working to grow and gain market share elsewhere, for the license plate manufacturer, which as I understand it is one of the only firms in the country that provides that, a in-state preference can work against them nationally. And that is always of concern for especially construction firms, that when they're at the margins of a district. I've got several firms that not only work in the Portland metro area but also go and compete on bids in Washington, because when you're talking about work in Vancouver, it's as close, if you are based in Portland, to go work in Vancouver, it is in fact closer than to come work in Salem. We would also say that it's important to recognize that, especially when we talk about construction services or other kinds of services, that there is an advantage to being locally based. Because anytime you start providing contract services and you are far away, there are mobilization costs. You have to go meet the client. You end up having costs associated with travel and other communication issues that if you're in the community, you don't have those same cost factors in your bid. So if you're an out-of-state firm, you have to think long and hard about, do I really want to come and make a presence in that market? Because if I do, there are mobilization costs involved that I wouldn't have otherwise had. AGC spent a long time working on the rewrite of ORS 279. I personally committed 4 years of my life to sitting and co-chairing the effort to rewrite the statute, and I can tell you that during that period of time, we spent a lot of time talking about reciprocal preferences, the benefits and disadvantages, and what it can mean to Oregon firms when we start talking about a preference. And honestly, despite the advantage that this may provide to a few firms that solely do work in Oregon, the reality for most firms, especially those that are trying to grow and create a presence on a region-wide basis, this can do more harm than good long-term. And so for those reasons, we would say that we would oppose this legislation, again, not in the desire to say Oregon shouldn't try and as much as possible award to local firms. And there are, again, inherent advantages to being local when you bid on a project, advantages that out-of-state firms don't have. But because of the reality of how public contracting statutes work nationwide, there are built-in disadvantages to Oregon establishing a preference. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. We're a national trade association that represents the high-tech industry, both electronic equipment, software, internet services, and the like. I thank Jessica for her comments, because mine do echo hers in the unintended consequences of disadvantaging Oregon firms who work outside the state. Typically in the industry I represent, particularly in the software industry, part of the industry, there's very few firms whose work is limited to the boundaries of Oregon. To be in business today means to be at least national, if not international, almost from day one. So you have a small, say, software firm in Washington County, Oregon, who's looking to bid on, if they're in that part of the business, perhaps creating databases for state governments or local governments. They're looking nationally from day one for customers. And given that almost all states do have this cross-retaliatory preference, anti-preference scheme, it's very common in almost all states, a bill that was intended to help them bid on contracts with the state of Oregon could unintendedly disadvantage them trying to bid on contracts elsewhere. And that's just sort of the nature of this business, is that would it were that firms today could exist solely in Oregon and do all their work here, and then we could give them a preference and we could keep the world within our boundaries and everything would be fine. But it's just not the nature of the changing business model for most companies, not just in high tech, but in lots of areas. There's three sets of preferences in the bill. There's the state preference, the local preference, as you heard about. Quick comment on that, and I understand the nature of trying to keep the work in Southern Oregon, but say there was a firm in Southern Oregon who wanted to bid on a contract from a state agency housed in Marion County. This bill would say that they are at a 7.5% disadvantage from day one on bidding for that work against, say, a firm located in Marion or Polk County. I find that almost trying to get too granular in the distinctions, pitting firms in Oregon against firms in Oregon, regardless of firms in China. We also find that provision somewhat troubling in creating this intrastate rivalry or set of preferences. Finally, the international preferences part, we had a good conversation in a different committee earlier this week on that subject. It's fraught with lots of complexities and WTO stuff and all that I don't understand very well. But I think all three of these sets of preferences do have problems and unintended consequences built into them. So that's why I would urge sort of a cautious look at this bill. Thank you.
I conceptually, I'm there. From my own personal experience, I worked for four contractors in 8 years, and I was in the labor's union. The Morris Brothers, we built a bus barn up in Seattle, and that was, I wanted that. That kept me working. And then Robertson Hayne Wallace, we remodeled the O.O. Howard House at Port Vancouver, and it's right over the border, right over the river. And then I poured concrete out at Intel for a real nice, happy span of time. So it's these kind of details, and somehow, and then this intrastate issue, I saw the representative shaking his head. If we do anything on this, I would like to hammer these things out. I'm conceptually there. I do have reservations. I've shared them with the good representative, and I will continue to do so. Any questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to mention, when we were remembering that license plate bill, which I was thinking about too, that actually was the reason we were able to do that is because we brought it under the state printing statutes, which do give a preference for in-state businesses. And so do you know, because it's not, you were right about that firm being the only one in the country that did that kind of work, but that certainly can't be true for printing in general. So why does it work for printing to be able to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I believe that's because when you're talking about printing, those are very localized services for the most part. It is customary. There are lots of firms here that do just that. You're looking to get a quick turnaround on that. So you're talking largely localized services for those printing needs. And if you do need something more specialized, I suppose you're talking about something that, regardless of the disadvantage, you can do that. That was a very careful policy choice on the part of the legislature, as I remember the discussions around that particular statute. But looking more broadly than just some of those services, I think you get into services that can tend to travel a little further. And so that's why we continue to be concerned about walking down this road, because most services in general can travel on the border. And when we look at my association, for example, we encompass Southwest Washington, and as we started to draw those lines, the reality is that we view Oregon, Portland metro area, and Southwest Washington as really one economic region. And so our concern about these kinds of measures is it really falsely draws a line on an issue that really would disadvantage Oregon firms in an area where there is one economic region. I would also say, and I get a little further afield, something that I forgot to mention during my earlier testimony is that the statute does provide for a preference in the event of a tie, and that doesn't get us into trouble. And in the event that an out-of-state firm and an in-state firm both provide the same price, and they both come in low, or they both score the same on a proposal, there is a preference to the in-state firm over the out-of-state firm. In the event that they're both in-state firms, most agencies flip a coin. These instances happen not frequently, but occasionally, and so there have been instances where in-state firms have gotten the advantage because most states provide for this kind of a preference.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Craven. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Jim Craven for the record. And I actually written down that citation, and I also forgot to overlook it just for the record. It's ORS 279A.120. And it basically says if price, fitness, availability, and quality are otherwise equal, the Oregon firm gets the, you know, gets the nod. It's sort of all things being equal. We do have a preference, and that's the kind of preference that doesn't get us into the cross-state retaliation issue.
Okay, so Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For my own information, when either out-of-state firms come to do contracting here or Oregon firms go elsewhere, is it largely a construction, specifically in construction, is it a construction management function, or is it actually, I mean, all the laborers go with the firm and do the work there?
Yes, the chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the answer is it depends. If you're talking about a situation where, again, you stay within the same economic region, and it's not only Portland, Vancouver, but it also can quite frankly be Baker or Ontario and Boise. You can have a situation where you not only take the contractor and the management team, but you also take the workers as well. We have contractors that are based in Eugene and Springfield, for example, that are highway builders. And their folks are trained to do specific work that meets specific guidelines and understand generally the process that that firm employs to get that work done. Those folks not only follow the contractor all over the state, but they'll go with them to Washington, or they'll go with them to California or to Idaho, depending on where the work is. And while we have a great construction program going right now, we would strongly encourage you to continue that momentum. It's another bill, another time. But that aside, when there's a lack of work here, our firms and our workers go to other states to stay employed. They continue to pay Oregon taxes and send money home, but they go where the job is. And so for the most part, the workers will go with them. On the other hand, there are times if it's further away, they'll send a management team and key personnel to run the job.
Okay, folks, unless there's something that we're going to hear this again, this is something absolutely compelling I'd like to move on. We have to hear. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to call, I'm going to call some state folks, Diane Lancaster and Mark Zoltan. Whenever you're ready, folks.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Diane Lancaster from the Department of Administrative Services at the State Procurement Office. You've heard much of the summary of the bill. I don't have much to add there, so I will be brief. We also spotted some of these same detail issues, and the written testimony that's being passed around to you highlights five basic items that we highlighted. One was the administrative requirement on proposers, which may add to contracting costs. The administrative requirements to agencies as they seek to apply this kind of local preference process and the limited authority that DAS may have over agencies that the sponsor would like to include in this circle of agencies. And then as to the state reciprocal preference laws, I thought it might be useful for you folks, and so I attached at the back of this written testimony an actual United States map with the highlights of states who have this type of preference law. And I counted them up, and by my count, there are 35 states of the Union who have a reciprocal preference law. And while the map is very dark, and I apologize for the printing quality, there is a listing there that specifically states which states do and do not. So, again, I brought that for your information. I asked Department of Justice to give me a quick read of this bill against the Oregon preference law, and their reading was that the language of the bill other states with general reciprocal preference laws, depending on the wording of their law, might well apply the percentage fee against our Oregon-based firms. So I thought that was probably useful to the committee. And then finally, there was a technical question around the scope, the complete scope of services that are covered by the bill. And I think it can be fixed in an amendment, but right now, the way the 279 is structured and the definition of services, the particular wording of the bill, I don't think gets to the professional services arena. I think it may only impact trade services or routine services, but this is something that, and I think Representative Clem mentioned this in his comments, that could be fixed. With that, we did think that the exemption procedure here was very rational and quite good, and I would be available for any questions you would have at this time.
Thank you, Mark.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Zoltan, Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here today to give testimony on behalf of Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner, who is otherwise occupied. Commissioner Gardner is a strong supporter of House Bill 3301. In fact, he had put in legislation this session, Senate Bill 201, that contained some of the provisions that wound up being taken over and incorporated into House Bill 3301. In particular, the section on the personnel deployment plan that would allow state agencies to know how many Oregon workers were employed at firms bidding on contracts. The commissioner is well aware of the alarming drain on family wage jobs here in Oregon and throughout the United States. Once again, I testified to this earlier this week, recent layoff of 800 workers with family wage jobs at Freightliner in Portland. In part because of a new factory being built in Mexico by the company, is an illustration of the effects of globalization. And at the very least, the state of Oregon and its agencies, which spend billions in taxpayer dollars each biennium, need to make an extra effort to make sure their contracts for services help employ Oregonians. And I thank you for your time and attention.
Thanks. Any questions of these folks? Comments? Thank you very much. All righty then. I'm going to call John Mulvey, Tom Chamberlain, and Jeremy Siegel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Mulvey. I'm representing SEIU Local 503. We are supporting the bill, and we'd urge you to do likewise. We represent more than 40,000 working people in the state. As Representative Clem said earlier, there's something very galling to a taxpayer whose job might be at risk, who's worried about health care costs, and sends a check off once a year to the state and then watches the state spend those dollars on services and goods from out of state. So I won't belabor the point, but just wanted to express the support of our members for the bill.
Thank you, Tom. Go ahead.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name's Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we stand in support of the bill. When you think about Freightliner and the 800 jobs that we lost, it's actually more than 800 jobs because there's a ripple effect, and that ripple effect washes over construction, service jobs. In all, we may be talking as many as 7,500 to 10,000 jobs lost by those 800 workers losing their jobs at Freightliner. And I've been in front of you many times, and I know that one of the struggles that you're having this session is how to most wisely invest dollars to create more family wage jobs, whether that's workforce, whether that's tax incentives. How do we keep and attract jobs in the state of Oregon? What hasn't been in the debate, though, is how do we leverage that money that we spend through state contracts? That has to be part of what we discuss in this legislative session. Because the jobs that we don't create, the jobs that we don't fund, will actually put a greater strain on our social safety net through unemployment, health benefits, so on and so forth. I urge you to support the concept of House Bill 3301, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Sir, go ahead.
Sir, my name is Jeremy Siegel. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I represent and own KFE Microsystems Incorporated, which is a small computer store located in South Salem. We've been in business here in Salem for about 25 years now and have bid on many dozens of state contracts and local contracts. Unfortunately, we've never been awarded any of them, largely due to price. Competing with the larger companies like Dell, HP, Compact, where they outsource, where systems are built and supported in usually outside of the country, paying people and with their overhead is just a fraction of the cost of what we have to do business here in Oregon. So, for example, when they go out to bid for 500 computer systems and our cost is a little higher, we lose the bid because, well, their cost is lower because these systems are coming from, China or Indonesia or the Philippines. And so we never get the opportunity to even get our foot in the door, even though the systems that we build are equally as good as, what they're purchasing. So we're very much in favor of this House Bill 3301. I think it'll do a lot of good for small businesses here in Oregon and, of course, keep a lot more of our tax dollars here in Oregon. KFE currently employs 4 full-time employees, and we are looking to, of course, be able to provide health care and other benefits to our employees and expand our company. And this bill would go a long ways in helping us accomplish that.
I just want to thank you for coming today and being engaged in and employing those workers at your company. I appreciate that. We all do. Any questions, these gentlemen? Thanks, guys. Would anyone else like to testify today on House Bill 3301? Thank you, Representative. All right, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3301. I'm going to skip down one to House Bill 3362.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3362 requires the Home Care Commission to elect workers' compensation coverage for home care workers state on behalf of the client, and it also allows the termination of temporary total disability benefits of home care workers who refuse modified employment in certain circumstances. This measure has been approved by MLAC. It is also similar in nature to Senate Bill 158A, which was just recently referred to our committee. However, the only difference is that House Bill 3362 mandates the Home Care Commission to elect the workers' comp coverage, while the Senate bill just merely permits the commission to do such.
And Representative Witt is not here.
I will go get him, sir.
Okay. We're going to just wait till we get
here.
And this bill is not amended. It's ready to go?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Witt, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Brad Witt, State Representative from House District 31, here today testifying in favor of House Bill 3362. this is a bill that, in essence, would make workers' compensation coverage a provision of state law rather than a provision as it currently exists of a collective bargaining process. There are very few people, in fact I'm not aware of anyone, who receives their workers' compensation coverage in this state by virtue of a collective bargaining contract. Now there may be some that I'm unaware of, but there would be very few. That's the case with the home care workers presently. And what this bill would do would require that the Home Care Commission provide coverage for all of the home care providers that are paid by DHS in servicing clients. And as a result of that, then, these home care workers would have coverage just like all other workers that are subject workers in the state of Oregon. The bill also provides for the termination of temporary total disability benefits under certain circumstances. And while I am not an advocate of this particular part of the bill, I also understand that the circumstances are somewhat unique and that this may be a necessary component in order to make this system work. Temporary total disability benefits, oftentimes known as time loss, under this bill, not unlike what is the case with most other workers, if there's a doctor's release for the injured worker to return to a modified employment, and that employee refuses to work, then benefits can be terminated. Now, in this particular instance, the employer, because the pay is coming through DHS, the employer is theoretically considered, I guess, to be DHS. So under this bill, you would be obligated to return to work at any client that has engaged the services of DHS for the employment of a home care worker. In other words, most workers' location and hours of work would be a consideration of whether or not you can continue your temporary total disability benefits or not. In this instance, the workers would have to go to work for any client that DHS referred them to. And with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's the best explanation I can give at this
point. Thank you, Representative. You did a great job. You know, when I first came here, I was amazed that the state was hiring all these folks to do all this stuff and not providing them with workers' compensation and unemployment insurance. So the state was doing it. So I appreciate you bringing this. Any questions, Representative Witt? Representative Esquivel?
Yes, I must be as naive as everyone else here because I just assumed that anybody that worked for an employer in the state of Oregon had to have workman's comp. But what you're telling me, the exception's the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, and I think we have to remember that this employment relationship is somewhat unique.
Yes,
in that the clients are actually those elderly or disabled workers, individuals who have received the services of a home care worker through the Department of Human Services. So because of that somewhat unique employment relationship, I suspect that is precisely why this is occurring.
Representative Berger.
I don't know if you have other testimony coming.
I have three folks.
Some questions that Representative Witt may not be able to answer, like how many?
That would be Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that would in fact be a good question to ask somebody else.
Okay.
Representative John Schultz is here, and we will be calling him up after we hear these nice people, because one of them is from more than 100 miles away. Any further questions for the representative? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Witt. I share your concern over this group of workers, but I'm kind of curious. Aren't these workers they're not really technically employees of the state?
And that's what I was trying to explain to Representative Esquivel earlier. It's a somewhat unique arrangement in terms of employment.
So are they determined to be self-employed people?
No,
we're going to have Mr. Schultz come up and answer these.
I'm not qualified, Representative Holby, to answer that question.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, all right. Any more questions of the good representative? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to call Carla Spence, Mary Wood, and Julia Huddleston. And Ms. Wood, since you're over 100 miles away, you can go ahead and go first. Oh, excuse me.
I'm close. I'm from the coast.
Okay. Well, whoever sits down first is ready. Go right ahead.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carla Spence, and I am employed with SEIU Local 503, and I've had the pleasure of working with home care workers for the past 6.5, 7 years. And to answer one of the questions that was raised, home care workers are not state employees. They are considered independent contractors, depending on who you're talking to, but their employer is the consumer that they work for. They are also covered by unemployment insurance. They've been covered by unemployment insurance for many years. Mm-hmm. So I am here offering testimony in support of House Bill 3362. And Representative Witt was correct when he said there are no other employees in the state that we know of that are required to collectively bargain for workers' comp coverage, from farm workers to janitors to CNAs to other kinds of workers that do not have to bargain for workers' comp. When the voters passed ballot measure 99 in 2000, they created the Home Care Commission as the employer of record for the purposes of collective bargaining. And we began bargaining on April 15th of 2001, and 17 months later, we had our first contract, and our workforce received workers' comp and health care coverage in April of 2004. The thing that makes workers' comp important, over and above the fact that these workers need to have protection from on-the-job injury, is that their health insurance coverage is directly linked to being covered by workers' comp. There's not a health insurance company in the country that would cover this workforce without having the workers' comp coverage. We don't believe it belongs on the bargaining table. We believe that home care workers should be treated just like any other valuable workforce, and they should have workers' comp coverage as a condition of their employment. We went to the bargaining table for our second contract and was told that both health insurance and workers' comp coverage were going to be ending. That was one of the positions that was taken at the bargaining table. It was very disconcerting to home care workers. Health insurance and workers' comp has literally saved home care workers' lives. Having this coverage has stabilized the workforce and has created an employment opportunity for home care workers to provide a valuable service in this state and not be afraid of being hurt on the job or not having access to health care coverage. It's just extremely important, and that's why we're asking for your support for this bill. We have worked very hard in partnership with the Home Care Commission, with the SAFE Corporation, with DHS and SPD to provide training to home care workers around health and safety issues. A lot of our trainings have been really focused on how to prevent injuries on the job. This month, we actually started a new training initiative that we're very proud of that is beginning to provide training to consumers of home care services that also provide them with information and focuses on some strategies around maintaining a safe workplace for the consumer. This is a very unique employer-employee relationship between the home care worker and the person that they're taking care of. And that person is not a typical business employer. They're generally a senior or a person with disabilities who's never been an employer before. We think this is the right thing to do. It doesn't cost any more money. The cost containment efforts that we have undertaken during the last 3 years, we will continue to endeavor to keep the cost down. The cost since we began is about 50% less than what was expected that the cost would be. And we will continue to be partners, but we believe that we should not have to be going to the bargaining table every 2 years under the threat of losing our workers' comp coverage and also losing our ability to have health insurance coverage. That's if I would entertain any questions.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go next.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Wood, and I am a home care worker and a member of SEIU and Home Care Workers Local 99. I support House Bill 3362. When you go out and apply for a job, do you ask your potential employer, am I covered by workers' comp? Well, you probably don't, because you assume you're going to receive it. Home care workers should have this same respect. Workers' compensation should not be something that is held over our heads at every bargaining session. That is, we're told if you don't have workers' comp, you know, you're going to lose it. If we lose our workers' comp, we lose our health insurance. It is demeaning for us to have to bargain workman's comp with every contract. Home care workers want the same respect that other employees do. Our consumer employers like knowing that we are safe when we're on the job, that if we have an injury, we will be returning to work. Our consumer employers need to have the security of knowing that we will be there for them. Without our workers' compensation, we have no health insurance. We need to be healthy on our jobs so we can care for one of the most vulnerable groups in our society. If I can't go to the doctor to take care of the cold that I have, I can't go and care for my hospice patient because I can't infect them with whatever I have. So I need health insurance so I can be healthy to care for my consumer employers. Our cost of workers' compensation has consistently been lower than what was projected in our bargaining. The passage of House Bill 3362 would not cost any more money for workman's comp than what is already being spent. The money's already in the contract. This bill will just give, I feel, will give home care workers respect that they deserve. What we do is a job. We do this as a career. I've been doing home care since 1989, and I will continue to do it as long as I can. And this is my job, and I should be treated like most employees. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julia Huddleston, and I'm from the Department of Human Services Senior and People with Disabilities Division. And I'm here to provide some information today about the Home Care Worker Program, workers' compensation, and House Bill 3362. I was lucky enough, and I do mean that quite sincerely, to participate in the first two contract bargaining sessions with Ms. Spence and the Home Care Commission and home care workers. It was a long process. It was a very interesting process. And home care workers are very dedicated folks taking care of folks who are very hard to take care of. And we support workers' compensation for home care workers. We just want to provide a little information. Home care workers are generally, they were statutorily excluded from workers' compensation coverage under workers' compensation statute up until the advent of the bargaining agreement. And they were statutorily excluded because they were viewed by Department of Justice as domestic service workers, and domestic service workers are statutorily excluded. With the creation of the Home Care Commission, there came a mechanism to allow workers' compensation coverage to be afforded through the bargaining process. Today, there's about 10,000 home care workers. And they take care of about 12,000 seniors and people with disabilities. They're paid by the Department of Human Services through Medicaid. These workers help clients with activities like taking a bath, things like house cleaning, things like meal preparation. The clients are their employers. The Department of Human Services, the easiest way to think of us in that relationship is as a fiscal agent. We're there as the state Medicaid agency. We can access the state funding to pull down the federal match. These are Medicaid clients. We negotiate wages and benefits, and in essence, we act as a pass-through for the money. Workers' compensation coverage for this workforce has posed some challenges that you don't see in traditional workforces. These folks are going into the homes of Medicaid clients, who are folks who are poor, who may not have any experience of an employer-employee relationship from the employer side, and who by definition have some sort of physical disabilities that they need some assistance with. each workplace is a client's home and presents its own unique set of safety challenges and health-related issue challenges. Some of the modifications, the physical modifications or ergonomic modifications that you might do in a more traditional work site may not be appropriate for a client's home, and since it is the client's home, the client may not want it in their homes. In response to these challenges in the 2005 bargaining session, SEIU, the Home Care Commission, and the Department of Human Services agreed to put aside a rather substantial amount of bargaining money towards a training partnership. And as Ms. Spence mentioned, this has been an active partnership. The Home Care Commission and SEIU and DHS have really partnered together. Everybody's quite proud of the training program that's been rolled out. And there have been positive things from the training program. When Safe Sanctuaries first attempted to put together an assessment rate for this population of workers, they came up with a rate slightly more than 3%. After 6 months of experience, it zoomed all the way up to about 7%. It's now back down at a rate of about 6%. Effectively, what our rate would be if we paid premiums was about 4.5%. But since we're the state, we don't pay the full premium rate. What we pay is a portion of that rate, and we agree that we'll pay claims up to 200% of their maximum for about 10 years out. So our claim volume continues to steadily increase because there's more periods of claims that we're paying. Our initial claim volume in the first year of coverage was about $96,000 a month. For the first 2 months of 2007, it's about $158,000 a month. And since it's this 10-year tail, we're still in a phase where the layers are building on the onion, and we don't get to a point where layers start to peel off the onion until about 2012 or 2013. So we support the workers' compensation coverage. We're committed to providing it along with the health insurance. We simply wanted to voice our concerns that this is a green workforce in terms of workers' compensation coverage. The layers of the onion are still building. And we wanted to voice our concern about the statutory guarantee of the coverage before we're able to do a true estimate of the cost with a full range of experience. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Take any questions. Representative Escobar.
Yes. I believe you mentioned about an independent contractor. Would you elaborate on that, please? That to me is it's a red flag.
It's not meant to be. Chair Schaffler and Representative Escobar, there's lots of different terminology that's used to describe home care workers depending on who they're talking to. They are employed by their consumer employer, by the client. Some people say they're independent contractors for the purposes of workers' comp, or they're independent contractors for the purposes of tax returns. And so they are employed by the consumer employer. They are not a state employee, but the consumer is not responsible for issuing their paycheck. The DHS is the pass-through. So set aside what I said about independent contractors. Some people call them independent contractors, but they really are not.
I think they're employees of the state. I don't even like this independent contractor conversation here at all. There are places where independent contractors are good ideas, but I don't think this is one of them. Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in this, too, because it is a sort of a unique construct. They work for an employer who doesn't pay them.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we add to the cost, we're not adding, and I want this on the record, we're not adding to the cost. The workers' comp isn't come from their employer. It would come from DHS.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. So let's get that on the record. Then I have, further questions. In your written testimony, you indicated there are currently about 10,000 home care workers. Are they all represented by SEIU?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, this group is all represented by SEIU.
Okay.
You know, I just don't understand. I mean, it's an employer who doesn't pay. The state pays them, but the consumer employs them. This is an Orwellian conversation. This is like figuring out how many. It's doublespeak, quite frankly, and you should not have to bargain for workers' compensation. If an employer walked into the labor's union hall, which they can't do this because it's illegal, and said, hey, we're going to start bargaining with you over your workers' compensation or your unemployment insurance, I'm confident of the reception they would get at that nice place. So, anyway, any further? Representative Berger.
No, I wasn't done, Mr. Chair.
Forgive me, Representative.
But I liked your speech. In your testimony, and I'm sorry if I forgot your name, but it's Mary. It's Mary. I can see it. You talked about the relationship between workers' comp and health care and coverage for you as an employee. Would you explain what your health care...
There is...
Okay. I don't care about the technicalities. Forget all that. Just answer the
Thank
question.
You.
That'd be fine. Yeah.
We're gonna forget all that. Okay.
There's no insurance company that will cover us for health insurance if we don't have workers' comp.
And Mr. Chair,
by all means.
Who then? I'm sticking with the protocol here, but you
okay.
Know so who pays? So none of you have health insurance?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. We've had health insurance for April of 2004.
But you bargained for workers' comp.
And we bargained for health insurance.
Ms. Orwellian, Mr. Chair, this is...
We bargained for health insurance, too. Right.
Okay, but you've had it. And whether this bill passes or not, you'll still have it.
We're bargaining right now for our third contract.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I can't say we will.
Okay.
Because we're in the process of bargaining.
Okay, got it. One other technicality, Mr. Chair, and this is for you. You're off the hook.
Okay.
Again, there is a fiscal here, I believe, and I don't see it, and I don't know what subsequent referrals we have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, there is currently no subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and the fiscal was not ready for the hearing. There was a fiscal issued on the Senate version, which there is no fiscal impact. However, because it just permits, this would codify.
And Mr. Chair, is it appropriate for at some point either you or your committee administrator to sit down with me? I will look up the Senate bill and I don't think I need to take the committee's time, but I'd like to know more about the difference.
And as has already been stated, the money is already there. This is not an increase of anything. It's already in the system, so it's not going to increase anything. And I believe in 2003 we passed the health insurance. Didn't we? Didn't that when you got provided health
insurance? Sarah Schaffler, no. The health insurance, and health insurance is a collectively bargained benefit.
Well, who did we? Well, anyway, reach back in my memory about something. Okay, well, thank you very much. Is there any more questions of these nice people? Thank you for coming. I appreciate it. Mr. Schultz, would you like to come up for a moment and just in case there's any further questions here, technical questions? Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Schultz, or would you like to just, is there anything in here you'd like to respond to yet, or?
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
And keep the time in mind for me, please.
I'm John Schultz with the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of Department of Consumer Business Services. I think the prior testimony covered the issues pretty well, and I'm here to answer any questions that I can.
Okay.
I don't have anything that I feel...
Any questions?
I need to say.
Ready then? Well, very good. Thank you very much. I thought there were some technical questions, but apparently not. I'm in a public hearing, correct?
Thank you.
Yes. I'll close a public hearing on House Bill 3362. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3362, and I would gladly entertain a motion. Representative Rosen.
Chair, I move House Bill 3362. To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3362 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yeah.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to move this without seeing the fiscal.
And I can appreciate that, Representative. We are on a timeline. This has went through MLAC. I believe there is no fiscal. I believe the money is in the system. I want to move forward on this bill today.
Okay.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair? I think you sort of answered this question when you said that the money is already being paid.
They testified to that.
It's a matter of right now it's having to be bargained, and we're funding it, and this would just make it automatic.
Right.
So.
Any further discussion? Kristen, call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse me.
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this on the floor?
I'd love to.
Representative Bowlby, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3362. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2758.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2758 changes the reimbursement rate for a recreational vehicle dealer for warranty service from 130% to 140% of the dealer's cost of warranty parts. You have a dash 3 amendment in front of you that replaces the bill. There are three parts to the amendment. The first section resolves a RV landlord-tenant issue. The second section clarifies language in the original bill regarding the warranty cost definition of parts reimbursement. And finally, the amendment adds new language to the Oregon Vehicle Code regarding RV shows.
And I call Sean Miller, Shannon Mill, I hope I'm reading that right, and Camille Pearson. I hope I wrote that. I think Sean scratched it on here, so
yeah, I can't.
I'll blame him for not being able to read it. Whenever you're all ready.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller. I represent the Oregon Recreational Vehicle Dealers Association. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and we're here in support of the Dash 3 Amendment. As Teresa indicated, it's a replacement of the bill, and I'll go through those three different parts of the bill that she described in the summary, and then turn it over to the rest of the panel members. To my right is Shannon Nill from Guarantee RV Centers in Junction City, and Cammy Pearson of Curtis Trailers in Portland and Aloha. And as indicated, the first section of the bill on pages, section one, pages one and two of the bill, Charlie Greff, an attorney with the Oregon Lodging Association, will come up and address that particular issue. I've been working with Bill Perry on this issue, and it's an issue that they brought to the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and it is agreed upon, and so I'll defer that issue to them. The second issue is dealing with warranty, the cost definitions in the parts reimbursement, and that is on Section 2 of the amendment, pages 2 through 4. This particular amendment, just a little background, in 2003, the dealers and the manufacturers passed franchise legislation. It passed unanimously through the legislature. This is just a technical fix to that legislation on the reimbursement of warranty that has been negotiated by the dealers and the manufacturers. Mr. John Brenneman, who is, I believe, sitting behind us, represents the manufacturers, and the language on these pages reflects that agreement. I'll defer to the panel to describe that issue. The third issue in the amendment is dealing with RV shows, and this particular issue, Mr. Chairman, the language in the Dash 3 amendments is unresolved. I will state for the record it's an issue that you'll hear from both Cammy and Shannon is important to the industry. However, we've heard from Monaco Coach, Affinity Group, the Motor Coach Association, Linn County, as well as the DMV on some technical issues. And so, from a policy perspective, I want to have them explain the reason why we're pushing this, but understanding that language is not quite complete, Mr. Chairman. So at this time, I'd like to just turn it over to first Shannon and then Cammy to describe the issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. And fellow representatives. My name is Shannon Neal, for the record, president of Oregon Recreational Vehicle Dealers Association, and my second hat is general manager of our family business, Guarantee RV Centers in Junction City. The reason we're here is to discuss the show language, and part of the House bill was created originally to protect the interests of the RV dealers in the state of Oregon, and it's worked well to that extent, although one component wrote in a exclusion for dealerships from outside of the state of Oregon not to do business in Oregon without a service facility and roots in Oregon. But we also found the need to want to exclude the two biggest shows that occur in Oregon every couple of years. That's the FMCA, Family Motor Coach Association show in Redmond, as well as the Affinity Group show that is also held in Redmond. Both happen to be there this summer. And these events for the association, for some of the smaller dealers, it does muddy the water a little bit, and it creates a little bit of confusion for the units that wind up on the used market, the trade-ins that come from these shows. And unless you're a larger dealer, you may not actually take part in the show. But the membership is pretty much split almost down the middle, a slight majority not in favor of the further exclusions beyond the FMC and Affinity Group, but there is a sizable portion of the Oregon RV Dealers Association that sees that not only is it good to exempt these two, there's about a $17 million economic benefit from any one of these shows, and add the ripple effect and it gets much larger. But there's also some related events. Each FMC event has pre-rallies that they hold in a town that's some sort of scenic location within an hour's drive of the event. There's some consideration for exempting that event as well because they go hand in hand. There's also the FMCA Regional holds a rally in Oregon at the Albany Fairgrounds once per year. That's got a large economic benefit. And then there's AGI, Affinity Group, who has the other big rally this summer in Redmond, has what they call a Sambree. These are events that we're working on, hoping to get exclusions, but like I said, not all the dealers in the body are in agreement there. But I would just like to say in conclusion that Oregon has a unique advantage for RVers. We have a beautiful state to come recreate in. We've become a regional hub for RV manufacturing in Oregon. Two of the largest manufacturers in the country are in Junction City and Coburg, Oregon, and we'd like to see those companies grow. It's a beautiful complement to Oregon's other manufacturing, and it's replacing some of the jobs in wood products that are not as robust as they had been in prior years. But thank you all for considering our amendments and our exceptions. Back to you, Chairperson.
Thank you, ma'am. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Cammie, and I'm representing the majority of the Oregon RV dealers that are in support of the House Bill 2758. And our position is against the additional exclusion of these pre-shows and manufacturer homecoming. I apologize. I'm not as prepared as I should be. This
You're
is
the
last minute. I'm taking someone's place.
You have a lovely smile. I bet you had fluoride in your water.
Thanks.
The reason she does is because she doesn't have fluoride.
Thank you. The majority of dealers that I am representing are either small business, smaller businesses, or those like myself that are towable dealerships. We do not sell motorized products. And typically, we're the dealers that are not involved in the larger rallies and that type of event, simply because they traditionally are motorized types of events. They're not exclusively motorized, but the majority, large majority are. Some of the things that the dealers are very concerned about are the state and local impact. Obviously, that's a positive. We do recognize the fact that we've gotten different figures that differ from 13, 17, all the way up to $30 million economic impact for the regions, and I'm sure that the truth lies somewhere in between. Something, however, that has not been talked about or will not be probably talked about a little bit later is when out-of-state dealers do come into the market area and sell the products, the profits typically go back to the states that they come from. So we're looking at sales tax, income tax, unemployment taxes, everything on down the road, going back and not staying in the community as it would with local dealers. The local dealers that are involved in the, or excuse me, that are not involved in the shows are the ones that are impacted the most significantly, simply by the fact that obviously they are in that immediate market area. Typically, when a manufacturer comes into a rally or this type of event, and I do have to apologize again because I'm not, as a towable dealer, I have not been involved directly with a rally, so this is kind of all secondhand, and Shannon can correct me if I'm wrong, but the typical procedure for a rally itself is the manufacturer will bring in, will typically ask the local dealer to participate, and for a number of reasons, he may or may not be able to do so. Local dealers, depending on their location, product lines, servicing capabilities, floor planning, availability, the volume of business. There's a lot of factors that go into whether or not he can participate, for one, and whether or not he chooses to do so financially is another. It is very difficult for local area dealers as well as dealers throughout the state to compete with sales from a rally type of event because of the fact that there's typically several different dealers involved with one manufacturer. So not only do the prices go down significantly, but obviously the overhead, and there's a lot of considerations there too, not only from the selling standpoint, but we also see a lot of the residual with the used market or used units kind of flooding the market. And but the biggest concern that we have is that of what we call orphan owners, and those are buyers who have purchased units that are basically left high and dry when out-of-state dealers will come in, sell a unit to a customer, and then leave town. Local dealers do not, on the average, we do not get complete reimbursement for warranty, pre-delivery inspections, all the types of things that we normally do, even walkthroughs, that type of thing with customers. We, as Oregon dealers, have invested a lot of money in our operations, and so for us to basically be expected or required to service these customers that we have not built a profit margin in to do so, it's very difficult. So when these customers come to us and they have been left, as we say, high and dry, and they say, we're here for service, and we have a list of this, 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 and this, typically if it's our own customers, you know, we're able to comply with that. But whereas we are not typically, you know, with out-of-state customers. So those are essentially the majority of the concerns that we have. As far as keeping it at kind of a level playing field, out-of-state dealers or out-of-area dealers typically have the opportunity to go into areas that are not that are unrestricted for the most part with different types of legislation, and they can move product quickly and more easily. So I guess that's pretty much all of what I have to say. I appreciate your consideration and considering the interests of the majority of the Oregon RV dealers, and would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, and I'm going to open this up. But before I open up, and this isn't just for your benefit, Sean, it's for everyone, and I think I'd like to open the Friday hearing with this. April 30th, we're not hearing any more House bills in this committee after April 30th. Legislative revenue and fiscal want every request, I believe, by April 20th for any impacts. That means all the amendments have to be by. That means we have 9 days, and this is for everybody out there. So get our ducks in a row, because after April 30th, there's always next session. And that whether this expedited process is to the benefit of the state or not, moving bills out when people aren't sure, I can appreciate that, Representative, is to the benefit of the state or not, remains to be seen. But I do know this much. The less time we're in this building, the less chance there is for mischief. So I just wanted to throw that out there, and I will be opening up on Friday, if you would remind me to do that Friday. So, Sean, did you want to follow up on it?
Mr. Chairman, an issue that wasn't covered in the bill, and I just want to cover it real quickly, is just the reimbursement issue on the parts, which, again, this is separate from the show language, which you just heard. And an agreement that was made between the dealers and the manufacturers was the 130% of the dealer's cost of a warranty part. And so, again, you have a warranty. Customer comes in, you're able to get reimbursed from the manufacturer 130% of that warranty cost. Well, what we didn't put in the bill, and it was a loophole, there's a way around it. Again, we're doing all the labor and all the work. If the manufacturer provides the dealer at the part at no cost, Well, 130% of zero is zero. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's just fixing that. This was agreed upon language by RBIA, which is the manufacturers and the dealers. Again, it just changes the loophole. It's part and the intent, I believe, of that particular session. That, I believe, Mr. Chair, back to your comment, we do have our ducks in a row.
Good.
Show language, again, I want to comment. The whole reason that we were putting this in is to try to protect our Oregon dealers. You'll hear from folks behind us of concerns, and we will continue that discussion with those folks. Thank you,
Mr. Miller. I never intended to imply that you did not have your ducks. Any questions for these nice people? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm just going to go right down the list, Chair and Paul. Frank Broderson, Charlie Griff, and Jim Phillips, please. I hope I pronounced all those. Might be grief. And whoever gets to sit down first is ready to go. Go for it.
I guess that's me.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Charlie Griff. I'm an attorney practicing law in Portland, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Lodging Association, or OLA. And OLA is the industry organization that represents RV park owners. And I'm here to discuss and testify in support of House Bill 2758, specifically Section 1 in the Dash 3 amendments. And the language that you see in Section 1 is an important and necessary piece of the bill because it addresses what we have referred to as the midnight move-in situation. This is a situation which occurs with fair frequency in RV parks where a person simply drives their RV onto a vacant pad without following the screening or application process, without a rental agreement or any approval of the park owner. And then when asked to leave, of course, they refuse. And with all due respect to law enforcement, when the occupant indicates that they have a right to be there, law enforcement will not assist. And what we're trying to do with this piece is to allow the RV park owner access to eviction court or FED court, which is a very fast-track, speedy remedy. I will point out that this has been discussed in the Landlord-Tenant Coalition. It has the full approval of the tenants, and specifically John Van Landingham and I have reviewed the Dash 3 amendments, and he is fully in favor of it and indicated that I could so represent to you here today. Without going through all of my testimony in too great detail, as we need to move along, if we don't have a landlord-tenant relationship with the person who drives their RV onto the pad, and if the entry is not with force, then you cannot be in FED court. You must do what's called an ejectment proceeding under ORS 105.005. That is what we refer to as a slow-track proceeding. It's a regular circuit court proceeding with a summons and a complaint and potentially months that go by before you get to trial, no less get an order that allows you to remove the occupant. This scenario can be easily rectified if these individuals can be brought into FED court where they will have due process, and if they feel they have a defense or some entitlement to be there, they can raise that in front of a judge. This also, the illegal occupant, the midnight move-in situation involving what we refer to as squatters, does pose a safety concern for the other lawful residents in the park. They haven't been screened. We don't know if they have a criminal history or not. And indeed, because the RV park owner doesn't want to accept rent from this person and create a de facto tenancy, they may go months without getting any rent for the space, whereas if someone who applied and was properly approved and signed a rental agreement, then they would. So I would ask that you vote in favor of this and send it to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you so much. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Sure, go ahead. Go ahead,
Chairman. Oh, I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
Chairman Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Frank Broderson. I am a volunteer with the Family Motor Coach Association, and I've been appointed to their Governmental and Legislative Affairs Committee. FMCA is a member-owned nonprofit association of folks who own motorized recreational vehicles. We were My remarks were prepared based upon the information that was current as of yesterday. Shortly after noon today, I was given an issue or sent a copy of the bill that you have before you. So the handout that was prepared for you has hastily been modified with a little wordsmithing. I am sure you will be less confused by what I have to say than I am.
Don't count on it.
We are opposed to House Bill 2758. Only those, what do you call them? Only those provisions that are limiting to dealers for participation in RV shows and rallies. Why? Let me just briefly tell you that we are the original RV-friendly state. And in order for FMCA events to be viable, an adequate inventory of motorhomes is necessary. We always invite Oregon RV dealers to participate, all Oregon dealers, because we bring a highly qualified market to one location for their benefit. Many may choose not to make that investment. Only if an insufficient participation by Oregon dealers is apparent do we then invite out-of-state dealers to participate. It is important for you to recognize that the International Rally of FMCA draws participation from virtually all 48 states or 49 states and many Canadian provinces. Our regional Northwest Area Rally that is annually held or nearly every year in Albany, Oregon, draws participants from 5 states and 3 Canadian provinces. I'd like to point out that the majority of sales made by dealers are made to out-of-state residents. It is extremely important that you understand that the passage of similar exclusatory legislation in the states of Washington and Idaho have effectively ensured that FMCA rallies cannot be held in those states. They can only be held here in Oregon. That economic benefit is enormous. It is $10,000 to $30,000 for the big show out of Redmond. It's $1.5 million or more for the annual show in Linn County, and then there is the spillover, as Mr. Neal pointed out. Most, if not all, of the regional, there are many other groups besides FMCA. There's the National Association of African American RV Owners, the Escapees. There are factory clubs from Airstream, Newmar, the Good Sam Sambarese, and many others will not be able to hold their events in this state if those provisions of this legislation are enacted. Most Oregon RV factories, there are 13 of them, and we do about 17% of the total RV production in the world, right here in Oregon. Most of those factories hold what are known as homecoming rallies, where multi-state dealer participation is standard. There are millions of dollars in tourism that will be lost if the onerous amendments limiting RV dealers' participation are adopted. And you're welcome to ask me any questions.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm Jim Phillips, also a volunteer. I am a past national officer of the Family Motor Coach Association, been out of office for 2 very lovely years, because it was hard work for 4 years, at no pay as a volunteer. But I'm here representing the ordinary RVer, because my wife and I are living in our motorhome. We recently traveled to Charlotte, North Carolina for a convention. It was the last convention that FMCA had last year. We drove from there into South Carolina, up through Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, on up into Maine, back across to Cincinnati, up to Michigan, down through Oklahoma City, west to Amarillo, and then down to the southwest part of the country.
Did you go through Iowa?
We did go through Iowa.
You skipped that, though. Right.
Well, we went straight to North Carolina, but we did stop in the little town of Moscow, Iowa, if you know where that is. there is a large firm there that does accessory work for motorhomes, and our motorhome had a little tiny problem, and they fixed it for us. Very efficiently, I might add. But the point is that we attend these conventions. We went to our first convention 15 years ago. We have attended, I believe it's 11 or 12 since that time. There are two a year, so we don't catch them all. But we're pretty typical of the people that go there. We've been to Perry, Georgia for a convention. We've been to Buffalo, New York for a convention. We've been to Minot, North Dakota, all over the United States. But one of the things that we know that when people come here to this place, although we will have somewhere between 4,000 and probably more than that motorhome couples coming to our convention, the bulk of them are not from here, even though 8,000 of our 125,000 members are residents of the state of Oregon. If we take the entire northwest area, as Frank outlined it, we have about 19,000 of the 125,000 members are in the Pacific Northwest. But the bulk of the people who come here are from out of state. We probably, on the average, I think that probably Shannon can confirm this figure, that the typical convention sells a total, and by the way, FMCA does not sell, you should understand that. We make it available for our members to meet the dealers, and the sales are made. But somewhere around 8 to 10% of the people who attend, believe it or not, buy an RV before they leave. And now, many of those people are from out of state. The dealers who are here in the state of Oregon would not have any opportunity to see those people or to meet them or to sell them anything if it weren't for this convention that takes place here in Oregon. And the side benefits are amazing. When you count the primary, the secondary, and the tertiary spending that takes place as a result of this convention, you're talking about a lot of money. We bring it here. We enjoy doing that. We all have a good time, including the thousands of people who attend it, and they happily leave their dollars behind them. Thank you.
Yeah, you know that young fella right over there, Sean Miller, I want you to take your concerns to him, and hopefully you all can get something worked out, because I want those sales being made here in Oregon. And I might add, them Iowans, they are efficient and hardworking, and they are friendly and good-looking, too. Representative Berger, I grew up in Iowa, so forgive me.
Mr. Ahmed, quick questions, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief.
Yes,
Mr. Griff.
Yes, Representative.
You are in favor of Sections 1 and 2 of the amendments.
Section 1 of the amendments.
That's a yes or no question.
Yes, I'm in favor of that.
And the other two gentlemen, you are opposed, both of you, to the dealer show provisions in the amendment.
Correct.
That, just wanted to get that. Right. That's what my notes said. I wanted to make sure I had it.
We are not in favor of fly-by-night tent show in-and-out dealers. We have no patience with those people whatsoever.
Neither would I.
We do not have any desire to impede or get in between negotiations between the factories and the dealers with relationship to warranty and franchise issue. We're just simply not involved.
Got it.
Any other further questions or comments, these gentlemen? Thank you, guys.
We really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thanks for coming. We really appreciate hearing from you, too. All right. I'm going to call Sue Bray and Jim Sheldon, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Sue Bray, and I'm not from Iowa, unfortunately.
I got here as fast as I could.
I'm vice president of Affinity Group, and we sponsor an annual RV rally around the country. In July of this year, we'll be coming back for the second time to Oregon at the Deschutes County Fairgrounds and in Redmond. And in 2005, we were there. We had approximately 5,300 RV families parked there, and more than 12,000 guests from all over the country. Coming back in 2005, and our registrations right now, we have about 3,000 people already registered. I'm sorry, for this year, for 2007, 87% of those people are from out of the state of Oregon. We understand that the Oregon dealers have concerns about the traveling fly-by-night RV shows that they're talking about, and totally understand how these people set up camp in Oregon, sell vehicles to Oregon residents, then move on and leave the local dealers to handle the warranty and service issues. And the legislative objective is perfectly understandable, as it is designed to protect the interests of both the local dealers and the purchasers. But this is not the case with a large national RV rally. In fact, it's just the opposite. Obviously, the 83% of the people at our 2005 rally who some of them bought RVs, the 87% at this year's rally, some of them are going to buy RVs, and they're going to take them back home with them, where presumably their warranty and service jobs are going to be performed. Local dealers do benefit from the influx of the new potential customers attending an RV rally, particularly when we and also our counterparts at Family Motor Coach Association hope and plan to return to Redmond on a regular basis. I believe that they have contracted for 2010 to be back in Redmond. We have been in discussions to come back in 2011. Affinity Group is the parent company of the Good Sam Club. We have more than 1 million families who own RVs around the United States and Canada, and 37,325 of those families actually live in Oregon. Our Oregon Good Sam organization holds an annual what they call a Samboree around the state. It's in Madras this year, and they get several hundred RVs at those events, again contributing. They're estimating that they're contributing 56,000 to the local community at most of these events. We are opposed to the section about in the bill concerning the RV shows. We are asking that there be some kind of language to provide some kind of an exemption for the RV rallies, because it really is a different animal than the tent type RV shows that they've been talking about. One suggestion might be that if, say, 50% or more of the guests at a rally are from out of state, then we could go ahead and the exclusion would not be applied. But thank you for your time. I'm happy to provide you with any additional information or ideas that we might have.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Sheldon, and I'm an employee of Monaco Coach Corporation, headquartered in Cobourg, just north of Eugene. I'm sure you're familiar with that area, where we employ north of 2,000 people. And in our last fiscal year had sales of approximately $1.3 billion. We build a highly discretionary product, recreational vehicles. No one ever needs a recreational vehicle, but as you heard the gentleman mention earlier, we have a large number of people who enjoy that lifestyle, and we have a lot of families in Lane County who benefit from the fact that those folks are in love with the lifestyle. And so we are opposed to Section 3 of this bill because for one specific reason, and I'm going to try not to repeat things that were said earlier for the benefit of getting through this as quickly as we can, but we're opposed primarily because it would shut down what we call homecoming rallies and pre-rallies. And these are events which are private in nature. They're not open to the public, yet they are attended, as the gentleman said before, probably north of 80% of the attendees come from outside the state. And if this bill were to go through, those private events, homecoming rallies and pre-rallies to the Family Motor Coach Association rallies and the Good Sam rallies, the Affinity Group rallies, any rallies, would be shut down. And as a result, we would lose a significant economic opportunity that we currently enjoy. We typically hold a homecoming rally for the benefit of everyone to understand what we're talking about once a year. We have six major brands. We have some subsidiary brands. And so these rallies will be attended by anywhere from 200 to 500 coaches, typically motorhome coaches. And these folks will then have an opportunity to be wined and dined. We will put on educational seminars. And we will invite dealers both from within the state of Oregon and outside the state of Oregon to participate in this event. And over the years, tremendous rapport has developed. Guarantee RV, represented by Shannon Mill this afternoon, when his testimony is one of the dealerships that has enjoyed great benefit from participating in these rallies. In addition, because they are held in the state of Oregon, we provide an excellent opportunity for these owners to visit our facilities, where again they take tours, and lo and behold, because of what they see, very many of them step up and purchase a new product. So it's good for the it's good for our company, it's good for the employees of Lane County, and it's good for the state of Oregon, in our opinion. And for that reason, we're opposed to the wording in Section 3, which would eliminate all of these rallies. And I also like to mention that, that Cammie does have a beautiful smile, and we enjoy excellent relationships with our dealers. And I feel confident that that we can work out the details with Sean, because as Cammie said, the majority of dealers are in favor of Section 3. However, if you're a baseball fan, that the score might be 5-4. It's not exactly like 9-0. I mean, it's again one of these things. It's there's a large number of dealers who are in favor of continuing with the rallies, and there's a number of dealers, obviously, who smaller dealers who are opposed to the continuation of the rallies. But we feel confident that we can work out the details with Sean Miller and bring this bill to a level that is acceptable to everyone. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
It's my pleasure. I don't want these rallies that help these small local areas being shut down. And I certainly, I don't think anyone in this committee wants to have any negative impact on your business that employs all those folks. So
thank you.
I hope you all do go get it hammered out. Any questions for these nice people? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I just want to comment that someday before I die, I want to understand how the Monaco coach sign down on the freeway changes color the way it does.
it's a miracle.
It is a miracle every time I look at it.
Yeah, we don't know.
Maybe they'll take you on a behind-the-scenes tour down there and explain it.
It might depend on my vote. That's scary.
Any more questions, these nice folks? All right. Thank you very much
for
all your patience and staying here so late this afternoon. Anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2758 today? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2758 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2219.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2219 makes technical changes related to implementation of House Bill 2181 from the 2005 session. House Bill 2181 authorized the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Manufactured Structures and Parks Advisory Board, the State Plumbing Board, and the Electrical and Elevator Board, and the Board of Boiler Rules to adopt rules regarding the governing of certification of persons that are regulated by the agency, including continuing education requirements. You have in front of you -2 amendments that do further tweaks to the measure. The most significant change is that it eliminates Section 2 of the measure.
Great. Very, thank you very much. Mark, would you like to come up and tell us what we're doing here?
Yeah.
Mark Long, excuse me.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes Division. What you have before you is the next generation of a work product we started last session with House Bill 2181 to streamline our licensing processes. At Building Codes Division, we issue about 42,000. We have 42,000 licenses in our system, about 85 different types that are administered with us through 7 different boards, if I remember correctly. And last year, we received authority to streamline all the procedures, make sure the terms, the renewal periods, the what I call the procedures to maintain your license and apply for your license to be the same, no matter which, whether you had an electrician's license or a plumber's license or a boiler or elevator, etc. During our rulemaking effort, we found more areas to streamline working with our boards, and so we bring to you House Bill 2219. We call it 2181 Lite, and it just deals with a few particular areas. We want to make sure that we use the same term for application. So if you look through the bill, it says application instead of exam and some other terms. We wanted to make sure in the boiler program, they have continuing education established in statute. In our electrical and plumbing programs, they do not. in our plumbing program, they required an additional practical examination, which the electrical and boiler programs did not, so we're reducing that. And the main piece that Teresa talked about is Section 2, which was language that is also going to be addressed in House Bill 2243. I believe it had a hearing yesterday in another committee. And what this did was allowed agencies to create flexible renewal periods for licenses, but if you did, let's say somebody has a one-year renewal and you want to offer a four-year just because it'd be easier to renew less often. If you did that, you had to offer two choices to the customer. Well, what happened is agencies, especially ours, the technology side of that and the infrastructure side of that became more difficult, and so we just didn't offer the four-year license, and that's what our customers wanted. So this allows us to do that. In actuality, most of our licenses are 3 years. We're moving from 1 to 3 years because it's easier for contractors to renew on that three-year basis. The other things that 2181 and 2219 allows us to do is you may have multiple licenses, and instead of carrying different licenses in your wallet with different renewal dates and different requirements, we can get all those procedures under one card and let contractors, workers, whoever, carry one license or renew at one time. And that's what we're trying to do here. This is a consensus product. We've put it through our Construction Industry Policy Advisory Committee, which is made up of management, labor, contractors, local government, all the folks that work in the building codes arena, and I'm not aware of any opposition to what we have on the dash twos.
Representative?
Just to be clear, on page 8, when you list the fees and you've added the word per year, that is just added language. It isn't a change in any policy.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, it is not. That what that does is allows us to offer a three-year license, and we would just, it's $100, I think is the case in this one or whichever one it is, and we could then go to a three-year license, and it would be $300.
No, it's up above A, B, and C, where it says $125 per.
Which page are you on?
Page 8.
Page 8.
$125 per year for an electrical contractor license.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a change in the price of the license.
Now, the license is $125 now. What it does is it will allow us to offer a three-year license and be clear that it's $125 per year for the three-year license.
Okay, is that a change in the price per the license?
No.
That's what I'm getting at. The license fee hasn't changed.
That's
it's
correct.
It's just the way you're...
That's okay, correct. That's as a matter of fact, in order to get consistency, if you look further down on line 28 on that page, we eliminate the $10 fee for the right to take an examination.
Yeah.
That was in the electrical program. The plumbing program did not have that, the other programs. So essentially the division is eating the roughly $13,000 of biennium we were collecting on that.
I just want to get on the record. It's
consistent.
Not a change in the fee. It's a change in the way you're...
Yep. And I want to clarify this too for my own information. It's not a one-time $125 charge now. Is that correct?
It is a $125 fee, but it's for 1 year.
Now.
So if we go to 3 year, which is what our customers have asked us to do, it would be
$375. So
right.
You're not increasing any fees with this bill.
I'm not increasing any fees. In fact, I'm reducing
the
electrical $10.
Thank you very much.
I
wanted that on the record, too. Any more questions for Mr. Wall? And we're ready to... This is all ready to go.
It's all ready to go,
Mark.
Sure.
Yep. All right. Thank you. If there are no more questions for Mark, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2219, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2219, and I'll entertain a motion. Representative Escobar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash two amendments to 2219.
Representative Escobar moves we adopt dash two amendments to House Bill 2219. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So move, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move 2219 as amended to recommend to the House for the due pass recommendation.
Representative Lescavel moves House Bill 2219 as amended to the House for due pass recommendations. Any questions? Any discussion? Seeing none, Kristen, please.
Representative.
Aye.
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 Excuse me.
Aye.
Aye. Would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
I'll do it.
Thank you, Representative Escobar. I'm going to close the work session, House Bill 2219, and I'm going to open work session on House Bill I'm going to open a public hearing on hospital. Well, I have to have
Yeah, that. Mr. Chair, yeah, we can't
work
that,
session on hospital 22795.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2795 requires the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries audit information used to determine prevailing wage rates and also modifies the maximum fee limits that are paid by contractors on public works contracts. We first heard this measure on March 28th, and there's still currently a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the measure.
Thank you. And I would like to call Jessica Adamson up here to discuss some potential amendments to this bill, please. Would the Bureau of Labor and Industry like to come up and discuss anything, or is Jessica going to be able to move on? Okay, go ahead, Jessica. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, and we appreciate the willingness of the chair to work with us on the concerns that remain in the industry on this legislation.
And Jessica, would you spread that appreciation around? Not just for just the chair.
And the sponsor of this legislation, the Vice Chair, Representative Holley, very much, which I apologize. As we discussed at the last hearing on this legislation, there was an agreement to sunset the increase in the fee. We are also seeking a sunset on the audit effective January 1st, 2011. So that we can have a chance to revisit how those audits are going, whether they're effective or not, their efficacy. And we also, as we understood from the Bureau, they needed the increased fee to buffer up the fund that, for a variety of reasons, including litigation that we are hopeful will stop shortly in response to a separate wonderful piece of legislation, that they needed to rebuild that fund to have adequate funds to administer the program. We're willing to support that on one other condition that the amendment will include, which is that we move to a public contracting agency paying the fee directly to Boley as opposed to the contractor paying the fee to Boley. We believe this is beneficial for many reasons. Primarily, today we're in a situation where we're required to pay the fee, but it kind of comes at an awkward moment where we don't always know what the amount that we're supposed to pay, and it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And what usually happens is Boley has to generate a letter, a nastygram, so to speak, goes to the contractor, says, hey, you owe us this fee, send it in which case then we pay it. And as we understand, they have a collection rate of about 90%. Today, public contracting agencies, when they award a contract, are already required to send a Boley a notice that they've awarded the contract amount, and any subcontractor disclosure documents. It occurs to us at that moment they could very easily cut a check for the amount that is due, that they already end up paying to the contractor as a matter of the cost of the contract. We all build that fee into our contract amount. They could cut that check directly and send that right away to the agency. The benefits are many. First of all, it's an administrative difficulty for the contractor. It's kind of something that we do, but like all other fixed costs in a contract, we add profit to that portion. So if it's a $5 million contract, we're paying a $5,000 fee. We add overhead, anywhere from 6 to 15% on average, to that line item, that bid item. And so you're talking about, and this is just industry practice, you're talking about significant dollars that are coming to us to pay this fee because of just how we calculate overhead. We believe this could be a significant cost savings to agencies. We conservatively estimate that it can be as much as $54,000 a year that public agencies could save by paying this fee directly as opposed to having the contractor pay the fee when we build in overhead and administrative costs. So we believe it's a responsible cost-cutting measure. It'll result in Boley getting their fee earlier, which can result in additional interest earnings, which should help the stability of the fund. And finally, my member said we're comfortable with the fee increase, if we can make this change, it will make our lives easier and streamline the process from our perspective. So that is the consensus, or excuse me, that is rather the content of the amendment that we are drafting and hope to have to this committee on Friday.
I hope we have consensus on the committee, but it remains to be seen. Any questions of Jessica today? Representative Holby.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe not a question. I wasn't aware that we were going to sunset the actual audit. And you know, and just from my perspective, I guess it wasn't when we were talking about the sunset that was discussed, and I believe Commissioner Gardner said he wouldn't have a problem with sunsetting the fee or putting a sunset on the fee. It was, you know, and so I just assumed this, you know, it wasn't really my idea of addressing this amendment. I didn't have an amendment drafted for that, so I assumed somebody else was doing that. So I apologize for any miscommunication on that. I still really, you know, feel pretty strongly that this audit needs to happen. You know, I get people pointing the finger back and forth about the accuracy of prevailing wage determinations and, you know, about the accuracy of them. Coming from agencies, public agencies, coming from the industry on both sides of the union and non-union sector, and I just really felt that this was a good idea because, you know, we really need to make sure that these surveys and these determinations are accurate. It has huge impacts to both public contracting agencies and workers. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, part of this. And then I was alarmed to find out that, you know, the prevailing wage fund, which funds a lot of things besides the surveys, for BOLI is in financial trouble looking over the next, you know, couple of bienniums. And so, you know, I'm not even sure we really need to sunset that fee, given the projection we have, and the Bureau of Labor and Industries doesn't usually fare all that well in the governor's you know, projected budget because they're not part of the executive branch of the our government, and or maybe they are, I don't know, but irrespective of that, you know, they really struggle to meet the demands of industry and people and wage claims and determinations and all these things that go on, and they haven't had an increase in a while, and we're just raising the threshold amount so much, you know. And I'm very willing to entertain this sunset and all that, but I'm kind of wondering whether we should go ahead and move this bill and work on that sunset on the Senate side, given what our chair has told us about our time frame for moving bills out. I would be amenable to continue to work with you on that sunset, but I'm really kind of anxious about holding this bill up to work on another amendment at this point. And, you know, I'll leave that up to the chair to decide, but, you know, I guess that's kind of how I'm looking at it right now.
It's in a lawyer's office now. If you all would like to talk about this after the hearing, I'd appreciate that because it's still in play. We could do some adjustment between now and then. And whatever we sunset around here, that means we get an opportunity to go back and look at it. And I don't worry, Representative, I haven't forgotten you. I would never.
No, you're not.
So it isn't like the legislature won't have an opportunity to come back and address it. If it gets people to feel less. I'm trying to get as many people to yes as possible. That's my goal in life around here. Representative Berger.
Never mind. I'm done.
All right. So if you're guys comfortable with doing that, we're not taking action today anyway. I do want to get as many people, not just committee members, but stakeholders to yes as humanly possible on this and every other bill in this committee. Are there any other questions of Ms. Adamson here today? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public the work session, House Bill 2795. Anything for the good of the order?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good day.
My pleasure. Same to you. We're adjourned.